I hope all you brethren and sisters this morning will realize that you cannot give me too much credit for having a sincere desire in my heart to say something that will be beneficial and uplifting and of lasting importance to you in your journey through life. One of the grand and glorious things connected with the association which I have with my fellow trustees of this institution and the general authorities of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is the assurance that each contact brings to me that these men have no interest in life other than the welfare of the people over whom they have been called to preside. We should always be conscious of the fact that those men who have thus been called did not seek the responsibility which now reposes upon them. But having once received and accepted the same, they devote themselves with a loyalty and a devotion that sets an example to most people here upon this earth who sense it. I want to say that this church, from its very foundation, is rich in its political history and in the political activities of its leaders. We have statements that would take me all the time allotted and more too to read concerning utterances that have been given to the Latter-day Saints through their leaders. And among those are documents that I personally prize more highly than anything else that has ever been written upon the subject of politics. We have from the very beginning fought for the right, the individual right, to act, conduct ourselves, devote ourselves politically to the cause which we ourselves believed in. There has never, so far as I know, been a time in the history of the church when the president of the church or any of his subordinates have ever undertaken to dictate to the people whom they should vote for. We have felt, however, from the beginning in this church that there were two kinds of political issues. There are some political issues that are debatable. I grew up as a young boy in a household where I heard little or nothing but tariff discussed. I had a distinguished father who was a Jeffersonian Democrat and who believed in free trade and did not feel that the burdens and responsibilities of a high tariff should be placed upon the taxpayer. I have heard it discussed by equally distinguished and eminent men that American industry in its infancy needed the protection which a high tariff gave to it, and that we were justified in imposing that duty upon the people in order to assure in return that free individual enterprises would grow and develop and thus make work, positions, salaries for the people. Well, now I consider that and similar questions as purely questions for the individual to debate, to study, and to make up their own mind. The church has never condemned anybody when they have been a free trader on the one hand or believed in a high tariff on the other. I could go down the list and name many issues that in the olden days, even in my day, were prominent in the discussions that preceded a political election. They seem to have disappeared from the scene. We all seem to be converted now to a high tariff because we have entered into a stage of government when the government has but one object in mind, and that is to see how much money it can raise so that it can spend it to perpetuate itself in power. Now, that's not a partisan statement. So far as I know, there has been that marked tendency of politics for a few decades past. And it seems to those who study government impartially as a tendency that should be corrected. We cannot go on without destroying the very foundations upon which our government are built if we continue to insist upon a greater revenue for the government in order to increase its expenditures. This tariff question brings to my mind the situation that existed here in these valleys of the mountains in the early days of the pioneers. I'm just as sure as I live that if we had followed the wisdom, the learning of Brigham Young, as a people, we would be far more prosperous today than we are. We would be independent of the world. We would never have needed the welfare program in the church. This city here was the city in which Brigham Young undertook to build a woolen mills. Now we produce enough wool to take care of our needs many times over. We had a woolen mill here that could have become one of the most famous and largest and finest woolen mills in the world, except for one thing. The people were unwilling to patronize their own institution. They felt that because for the time being, when the railroads came in, they could get woolen goods shipped in here from the large woolen centers and purchase them for a few cents, a pound less or yard less, that savings was more important to them than the establishment of a permanent, prosperous industry, little realizing that by their own efforts they could have made that industry grow to such proportions that it could have competed with any and all mills in the world and have given them ultimately a product much cheaper. Now today, we raise wool in this country. We ship it to Boston. Practically 100% of our wool grown in Utah is transported to Boston. It costs us 3 to 4 to 5 cents a pound to transport the wool in the grease. And that's about the only way it can be transported. It has to be cleaned where it is to be manufactured into textiles. Now, when the textiles are finally manufactured, then we pay a high transportation cost to have those very goods brought back here for our consumption. And therefore, the price which we pay for woolen goods involves and includes of necessity the tariff on the raw wool back and the manufactured wool here, which is a very considerable item and will continue to increase as it has in the past because of the continued increase in the excessive costs of transportation. We could just as well be competing with the markets of the world and give to our own communities a stability which it now does not have. Now that, in a way, illustrates this question of high tariff. We would have had to pay a few cents voluntarily more for the woolen goods in those early days than we did for goods from the East, in order to build up and establish industry, so that we see in the earliest days here, colonization of this state, that we had a difference of opinion among the people as to whether they should buy Eastern products or local products. I have not been able to accomplish much in my life, but what little I have accomplished in an industrial way has been to establish local industry in Utah. I have been a great convert of Brigham Young, and I've never read anybody's philosophy that quite equaled his. As he taught the people, or undertook to teach the people of this state what they should do and how they should live, I commend his teachings to you men and women who are starting out with the greatest opportunities and the greatest future in life that has ever been given to any group. And here you are, my brethren and sisters. Many of you have had the blessings, privileges of a mission, and you have come back with an ambition that is not to be found elsewhere in the world. I had occasion Sunday to say something about the possibilities of this institution becoming great, and you'll pardon me if I say one further thing in that connection, and that is that this university will never be any greater than its alumni. That's just impossible. That's a trite saying, but it's nevertheless true. And so as you men and women go out into leadership in the world, and that's our field, you should go with a firm conviction in your heart that you're not going into the world simply to make a success for yourself, but to make the world a better place to live. And today we are so hemmed in, bound down, and tied together with legislation, with rules and regulations that take upon themselves the force and effect of law, that if we are going to fulfill our mission in this world, we are going to, of necessity, take a part in the enactment of those laws. We are going to, of necessity, cast our oar into the water and seek to change the direction in which our canoes or our boats or whatever they are now traveling in. I'm sure that the brethren would not be so exercised as they are if things were all right. I know I've gotten tired of seeing in the Deseret News, or I did some time back, the emphasis they gave on the three departments of government in every issue. But as I've grown older, I've seen the wisdom of that. The Constitution of the United States is something that we cannot discard, and there's no better way to discard it than to do away with the checks and the balances which it provides for in these three great departments of government, the executive and the legislative and the judicial. The 101st section of the Doctrine and Covenants says, according to the laws and constitution of the people which I have suffered to be established and should be maintained for the rights and protection of all flesh according to just and holy principles, that every man may act in doctrine and principle pertaining to futurity according to the moral agency which I have given unto him, that every man may be accountable for his own sins in the day of judgment. Therefore, it is not right that any man should be in bondage one to another. And for this purpose have I established the constitution of this land by the hands of wise men who I have raised up for this very purpose, and redeemed the land by the shedding of blood. That's our conception of the Constitution of the United States. Now, what's happening today? We have an executive, and I'm not talking about the present incumbent alone, but some that have preceded him, who would, through the power which is his of appointment, give to each member of Congress that patronage which he in turn needs for his perpetuation in office, and thereby solicits from those to whom he gives this patronage their support. The result of it is that every senator and every congressman in Washington today who does the will of the president gets rewarded remuneratively. I don't mean in dollars and cents, but by having the privilege of selecting those men who should hold public office at home and abroad. And as those offices have multiplied, the president's power to confer patronage upon the legislative members has increased. And it is not an uncommon, but rather a daily and almost an hourly experience in Washington today, that legislatures are either persuaded or coerced into doing the will of the executive because of the executive's ability to either give or take from him the patronage which he in turn wants and in many instances feels that it's necessary for him to have in order to perpetuate himself in his office. The president has already, as we know, the executive officer, not only recently, but all through the history of the United States, there has been a tendency on the parts of presidents of the United States to dominate the judiciary because of his power to appoint. And whenever we find a movement which seeks to give to one person domination over the other branches of government, why then we can see a movement which causes us to take a step closer to an absolute totalitarian form of government, contrary to the will of the Lord, and in violation of the Constitution of the United States. I had something to say to many of you Sunday about moral issues. It goes without saying that we should uphold and sustain those who will bring morality and religion into government. Washington's statement is classic, and it's read on many occasions, and maybe I shouldn't read it here today, but it fits in so beautiful with what I want to say. Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. Now read that statement of the father of our country and then ask ourselves, should the church take any part in politics? Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. Now how are we going to give those supports to political prosperity if we keep our mouths closed concerning political matters? I want to say to you today that just as sure as we live, the only reason that we have become so circumspect in what we say about politics in our religious gatherings is because of the influence and the effort that our enemies have made to close our mouths. And don't let anybody fool you on that. Moses was the great lawgiver of Israel, and he was their prophet and a prophet of God. And had it not been for his religious and moral convictions, what would have happened to the people of Israel? When they left Moses and his council, they went to destruction. And it took them 40 years to get where they might have gotten in a few months had they followed the counsel and admonition of that great political leader and at the same time a prophet of God who held the higher priesthood. It's no different today. I say that the mouths of our leaders should not be closed and that we should never permit anybody to inculcate in our hearts the idea that we in this church cannot speak concerning matters that depend upon which our independence and our freedom depends. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness. That is religion and morality. These firmest props of the duties of men and citizens, the mere politician, equally with the pious, ought to respect and to cherish them. We had a man in a state convention this year ridicule his opponent because he said he had religion. Why, when a man does that, he condemns himself to the voter by the very words of George Washington, whose memory we all revere, or at least we claim to, even such politicians do. A volume could not trace all their connections with private and public felicity. Let it simply be asked, where is the security for property, for reputation, for life? As long as I live, I want to feel secure in the home in which I live. And I care not whether it's the humblest cottage in the land or the most beautiful palace. Under the law, the Saxon law, which is our law today, a man's home has always been his castle. And they've all but taken that sacred home of ours away from us, deprived us of freedom, the liberty, the security that we have a right to feel in our home. That's property. Where is the security for reputation, for life? If the sense of religious obligations desert the oaths, which are the instruments of investigation in the courts of justice, why, perjury has become rampant in our midst today, and men think it smart if by perjuring themselves they can take that which belongs to another away from him, whether it be his property or his reputation or his life. Now, these are things that are not debatable. They're not like the tariff of which I spoke. Those are things that no man can debate. We all must stand for them if we are to be good citizens, if we are to be good Latter-day Saints. And there has never been a moment in the history of the church among our own people where these matters have been debatable. They fall in an entirely different category than does questions that are similar to the tariff, or our banking laws, or many others that might be mentioned. Reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principles. Tie national morality and religious principles up just as tight as you can, and the tighter we bind them together by our loyalty to the Constitution of the United States, the greater will be our government, and the greater will be our freedom of action, and the greater will be our opportunity in life. Do you, young men and women, think for one moment that opportunity lies along that course along which we're now proceeding? To have at every turn, in relationship to every human activity and experience in life, to have some order come out of Washington telling us that there will be funds on hand to help us to follow the course we should pursue, provided we follow the mandate of that federal order. I heard a very reputable man who spent his life in the teaching profession say the other day that when it comes now to building school buildings, if there's any federal aid given for that purpose, you have to ask Washington which side of the door you hang the hinges on and what kind of hinges you hang and from whom you shall buy them. So detailed has become the regulation and regimentation of this situation. And then in addition to that, they tell you who you can employ in order to build the school building. I'd rather build my own school building and build it the way I want, with the labor I want, and feel free and independent of anybody else. Do we want anybody else in the government to build our school buildings? One of the greatest experiences as a lawyer that I've had in this state was to go down here into one of the poorest counties in this state, where the people had the least. Now, that may apply to several counties. Maybe some of you are from several of them, but I'm only talking about one, which I think was the worst off of all. They went to the federal building in Salt Lake. They needed a reservoir. And government officials there told them how that reservoir could be built. That it would take $80,000 or $90,000 or $100,000 to build it. And the government would give them the money provided they did what the government told them. Of course, they'd have to pay the government a rate of interest. Well, that group of courageous men got together, and I take some credit for having gotten them together, although they readily accepted the suggestion. The reservoir stands there today built, and the day it was built, they owned it. They didn't owe a penny on it. They built it with their own means, with their own labor. And they've got just as fine a reservoir as the government could have built them. And they're a happy and a prosperous people as a result of that. Then they went on, and before they got through, they had built 7 reservoirs. And then a neighboring county over the hill, I've been after them now for over 10 years to try to build a reservoir, and they're still waiting for the government. And when they do, the government will build it. Maybe, if they don't run out of funds before. But when they build it, it will be the government's, and the government will control the distribution of water from that reservoir. And if we're following along the same tendencies that we're going today, it'll go to the favored few. When I was a boy, the Republicans' Party stood for special privileges, according to us Democrats. I wonder now what my good old party stands for. Well, I'm talking too long. I wanted to say this before I got through, and I'll try to bring these remarks to a conclusion in a minute. Surely the Lord God will do nothing, but he revealeth his secrets unto his servants, the prophets. He has taken occasion, my brethren and sisters, and this is the one point I want to leave with you, to tell us in his revelations to the prophet Joseph Smith that this constitution of ours is a sacred instrument. Now suppose that the general authorities of this church were to differ on what we ought to do with respect to the Constitution of the United States. Wouldn't you immediately be justified in coming to the conclusion that there was no unity in the church on a matter about which the Lord has spoken? Does it surprise you to know that all of the brethren have the same feeling toward the Constitution they do? And it's hardly conceivable that it could be otherwise if they had the spirit of their office and calling. President Grant said, "I want to impress upon the minds of Latter-day Saints not to covet that which belongs to any public institution or that which belongs to any city or county of the United States." Unless I am mistaken, many people have said, speaking of the distribution by the government of supplies to the people, "Well, others are getting some. Why should not I get some of it too?" Well, that's an argument that's easily answered. The world does a lot of things, but because they do those things is no reason that Latter-day Saints are justified in doing it. And when the government makes a mistake and gives away that which it should retain, it's no virtue on our part to partake of that simply because somebody else does. If we're the only people upon the face of the earth, and it looks to me the time's rapidly coming when we are a few at least of the people that still have in their hearts a desire to maintain this God-given constitution, that then when we go to the polls and vote, we should be sure that we vote for men who will uphold and sustain this constitution and its integrity in season and out of season. And when they seek to give people something for nothing, we ought to examine those gifts very carefully. It's been said, you know, that those who receive gifts from others become subject to the will of those others. And all we need to do is to have those gifts continue long enough. Well, now I hope and pray that we will sense the importance of taking an interest in politics. I hope most sincerely that I'm looking into the faces not only of future leaders of this church, as I said Sunday, I know that's true. You men and women cannot help, even if you tried, long as you behave yourselves, from finding yourself in positions of responsibility and leadership in this church. And then when you get there, you'll know what an arduous task it is. But I hope I'm looking into the faces of men and women who will dedicate their lives here and now to activity in politics, in civic matters, with an eye single to making our country a better place to live. And I say we cannot do that unless we create in our thinking here in this great university a fairness. Now, in conclusion, I'm going to just say one word. I've been debating whether I should say it all morning or not, but I'm going to. You have a paper on this campus. It professes to be nonpartisan. Your president has had an invitation from both of the major political parties to organize political clubs and to have political activities upon this campus. Now, in his wisdom, he has seen fit to say no, and I'm sure that we all unanimously agree with that decision, that this school should not be turned into a political arena. Now, those men and women in this institution who have a love of this institution and a love of fairness and a love of equity, you know, I taught equity for 27 years in law, so I'm quite an adherent of equity. It's a good thing to be, too, would never permit themselves to use any agency of the university to defeat that principle laid down by your good president. Now, no matter how partisan you are, and I'd like to see you get partisan. I'd like to see a lot of you be good Democrats and get in and make the party better. You see, I'm not so interested in the Republican Party, having been a Democrat all my life, but I'm sure that without any admonition for me, many of you will be Republicans, and I hope you will. And if you are Republicans, I want you to be good Republicans. And not go into politics in order to enrich yourself, but to make the government better. Now, be as partisan as you will, but when, as a partisan, you come into an institution of this kind that is nonpartisan, then do not permit yourselves to fall to the temptation of utilizing any facility or any agency of this university to propagate your own partisan ideas. And that includes your student paper. Let's be fair. The Lord bless us all to be good citizens. That's just the foundation upon which we can build good membership in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen.